This is the MedicCast, March 10th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the MedicCast. This is episode 108. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome all of you to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the MedicCast, I urge you to head over to MedicCast.com. Check out all of the links and information available over there. There are links to the other shows in the MedicCast network, including the Nursing Show and the MedicCast News, as well as links to the blog for both the Nursing Show and the MedicCast. And when you get there, you'll find links to everything I talk about in each episode under the podcast category, and also articles and information on studies and research and interesting news items that I post about throughout the course of each week. All of that available over at the MedicCast site. If you're a long-term member of the MedicCast community here, I want to thank you all for joining in again, helping out with your comments, your questions, your corrections, everything that you do to help keep the MedicCast community here alive and well. I want to thank you again for staying subscribed and staying involved here in the show. Another great way to keep in touch with the show is to head over to the MedicCast forums. It's free to join up over there and a great way to participate in this community and ask your questions there, get your questions answered, or answer somebody else's question. It's a great opportunity. You can share photos, video, all kinds of stuff over at forums.medicast.com, and that is a great place to keep in touch with the other listeners directly here at the MedicCast, and a thriving community and a lot of great topics that have been posted up over there in the past week. I'll jump right on into some of the email I picked up this week, and I want to first of all talk to listener Harris, who sent me some information on what he's been doing as a first responder for the Navy, and he's interested in getting involved and training as an EMTB, wants to know a little bit about what he can do to get started on that path. Well, I'll tell you, Harris, it's a great way to get started just by checking in here at the MedicCast. So you've gotten your path moving just by finding this podcast and other great online resources to start your training a little early. It'll give you a little bit of a head start to listen to the things we talk about here, either in the news or as part of our tip and trick of the week or med of the week. And you can also find out more information about what we do in EMS in the civilian sector. The other side of that is that every region handles their EMS training differently. In Maryland, we provide a great support system here through the state for our volunteer fire and EMS service. Part of that is that EMT classes are offered for free through the University of Maryland on a regional basis. They go around and teach classes each semester to the local areas so that fire companies and EMS services can train their personnel, and it's a support network for the volunteers here. And other places around the United States do similar things. Also, another common method of training is through local community colleges and trade schools, and those programs are available for some fee, but they usually aren't too incredibly expensive. And in fact, some regions are offering job training vouchers and some sort of tuition support to provide for additional training for their local responders. So you'll have to kind of look at exactly where it is you are planning on starting your training, and that'll give you an indication of what you need to do to get started. You can always contact local fire companies in that region or local EMS services and find out what they do to train their personnel, and that'll give you a start. So I hope that helps out with answering that question for you and for anybody else that might have had a similar question. I also got a couple of emails this week from listener Joe and from listener Jim. Jim also contributed some information that I've put up on the Medicast blog. You can find that in this past week's postings. He wanted to share some information and thoughts on an episode that he's been listening to from the archives of the Medicast having to do with schizophrenia, and wanted to comment on some of the things that I talked about during that particular show. You can check out his comments there. Plus, both he and Joe sent me several links concerning recent stories on EMS in the news, and I always appreciate getting that information in. Don't just assume that I found a story you've looked at in my searches throughout the week for information, because you just can't assume that. There's so much information out there, there's no way I can cover it all, and I really rely on the community here to help keep me straight on what's been going on. One of the things that Jim sent in also was a story about a call where a person called in from home to report a fire. This was an individual who had MS, called 911, was initially put on hold, and then was misunderstood for some reason. There's a link to the transcript, and I think maybe I'll post that later this week and talk a little bit about it in more depth and follow up on the tragedy involved with that particular call. But it's a certain reminder for all of us on why we retrain the same things over and over again. Yes, this 911 caller knew how to take calls, but it doesn't mean that you don't get a call that throws you for a loop or is difficult to understand or maybe misunderstood. And so this is why we retrain the same things over and over again, to make sure that we cement some of this knowledge in our brains in different ways and at different times, so that we continue to learn and be open to changes that may be coming along. So I'll look at that a little bit later on, as well as some of the links that Joe sent in. And thanks, guys, for contributing to the show. Next up in the email front, I got an interesting request coming in from a listener from Mexico. This is from listener Jose, who's a volunteer paramedic in Aguascalientes, Mexico, and wanted to check in because their volunteer unit works with limited supplies and wanted to find if there was a way that used equipment from services here in the United States might be made available to perhaps be sent to his and other volunteer organizations and EMS agencies in rural parts of Mexico. And this isn't something I'm really aware of very much, but I thought I would check in with you, the listeners. You know, there's thousands of Medicast listeners out there. So maybe some of you are aware of organizations or resources that would allow us to reliably send used equipment and refurbished equipment that we are no longer using in our services to places like rural parts of Mexico, South and Central America, as well as other parts of the world. Specifically, Jose is looking for some kind of a defibrillator that they could use, either a 3-lead or a 12-lead EKG, perhaps a pulse oximeter, suctioning equipment, and airway and intubation equipment. So is there anything out there that we can use to help out this service as well as others? This might be an opportunity for us to start getting a clearinghouse of this information together and put this information out there on the Medicast site. If you know of anything, get in touch with me here at podmedic@mac.com. That's our email address, podmedic@mac.com. Or you can call me over at the voicemail line and leave a message there for me at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Time now to look at our link of the week this week. And what would each month be without each episode of the Medicast Live? And coming up this month, we have a very special episode planned for everybody. And that's going to be a good look at what it takes to be a good student in EMS. And I'm talking about from the first responder all the way up to the person who's looking at critical care medicine. We need to really delve in depth to what it is that's made us successful and share some of those tips and information with the students that are ongoing in that process right now, as well as learn a little bit ourselves. You know, what made me successful doesn't mean that I can't learn something from what made you successful. And I think that's one of the valuable things we can do here this month on the Medicast Live. If you haven't shared with this is an opportunity for you to participate in a live call-in style radio show with myself, Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast, as well as other special panelists that I'll have lined up coming up this Tuesday night. That's Tuesday, March 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern time here in the U.S. So schedule your time. I made it late so that even people on the West Coast of the United States can check in with us and find out what's going on, as well as people in other parts of the world. Perhaps isn't so hard to schedule yourselves around what's going on here at the Medicast. And, it's an opportunity for you to call in live. You can also listen to it streaming live over the web. You can listen to it live on your cell phone. There's just a whole host of different ways you can connect. Head over to MedicCastLive.com. Check out the service over there. That's hosted over at TalkShoe.com, TalkShoe.com. You can register for free. It's easy. You can find out how you can share information and host your own web shows directly there. But you can also check in Tuesday night for the next episode of the MedicCast Live. There's live chat going on in the chat room. People are listening live streaming. You can call into the show and get your questions answered, talk to myself and the panelists, and share your information with the other Medicast listeners. So that's coming up this Tuesday night. I urge you to check it out. It's going to be one of the best episodes we've hosted for this particular series, and I'm really looking forward to it. Time now to move into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a great story I found over at EMSresponder.com looking at a very difficult rescue situation that faced North Carolina responders recently when a worker in a cigarette plant got his fingers and hand pulled into a packing machine where the rollers and the pins in that machine actually pierced through his hands, trapping him in the device and the equipment. And this particular story really reminds me very much of the episode that I hosted and shared from Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast, where he interviewed a responder in New York and command chief that was involved with a difficult elevator rescue. And just reading this story gives me a sense of a similar difficult rescue situation that was made better by cool thinking and perseverance to get the job done, and a good use of all the resources available at hand. I'll let you head over and check it out for yourself, but it serves as a reminder to all of us to be aware of additional resources available in our communities, be aware of outside resources we may not commonly use, such as bringing in surgical teams to assist, if necessary, with a potential amputation situation. Thankfully, that wasn't needed in this case, but they did avail themselves of that resource and had it waiting in standby mode in case they were unable to dismantle the machine appropriately. The other side of this picture is that it's important for different agencies in regions to work closely together and to practice working closely together so that there's an understanding of who does what, where, and how the job's going to get done. And this happens, I think, frequently in most areas based on my understanding, but I think that there's always room for more and better interaction and improvement on this process. And this can be done both at the command level by having chief officers and command officers working together, meeting together frequently, sharing information, looking over each other's equipment so that you know what's available. Maybe a neighboring agency just got something new in. It's a perfect opportunity for you to have them come over and show off their equipment in your facility and show what they can do that they couldn't previously do. Maybe this is a way for you to talk about interactive training, to talk about splitting up the resources. Say one agency is going to take care of heavy rescue situations, another agency is going to take care of having confined space rescue capabilities. These things are all certainly something that we can plan ahead for, and when a difficult situation comes up, we will have a better handle on what resources are close at hand and what we need to bring in from the outside. Next up is an item that caught my eye. We had a recent discussion talking about bus accidents and why do we always rehearse bus accidents and practice those kind of things, school buses and things like that. Part of it is because it's our worst nightmare is a school bus full of kids injured in an accident. It's the ultimate, I guess, bad situation, MCI, when we're looking at what we expect to see in our locality and what we don't want to see, especially since many of us are parents. So, interestingly enough, there's been several bus accidents, some of them serious, in the news recently, and it brought to my attention the reason why we practice for bus accidents. They're a difficult situation to handle, and they provide unique problems and challenges to scene management and patient management that we all could stand to have a second look at. Most recently, I am looking at a EMS responder article on a Georgia bus accident where a bus overturned, knocked into some power lines. Many children were injured. 27 students were on the bus. 11 of them were taken to local hospitals. Some of them were in some form of serious condition, but nobody critical. But it does recall that there are going to be different challenges and things that we run into when faced with problems like bus accidents in school buses. And I want to point you to the Medicast website and show notes for this episode. I've linked to a recent podcast that Rick Rosati placed up over at the Mitigation Journal podcast. Rick's been very ill lately, but he's back in the saddle, so to speak, and has been turning out his regular shows. And the most recent regular episode that wasn't an in-service program for paramedic training was a talk about some of the unique challenges facing preparation for school bus accidents. And really, you know, this is why I like having Rick as a friend, because he thinks about things that I, in my experience, would never think of. And because of his broad instructional experience and experience as both a fire officer and a paramedic, he brings a unique look at how to handle some of these difficult scenes. And I would urge you to head over and check out his episode. And I've linked to that in the show notes so you can go over and download that show. I'm sure many of you have already picked it up in your feed and have listened to it, but you'll understand what I say when I mean he just thinks of things that wouldn't occur to me but are certainly very important, including crowd management. You're going to have 27 kids in this bus accident. You're going to then have 54 parents showing up, irate, pushing past your police and crowd control, trying to get to their child and endangering everyone in the scene because of how they want to get to their kids. And not that I blame them, but we have to control and be prepared for that, as well as press control and management and just dealing with a difficult situation in a rescue. So check out Rick's article and posting and download podcast on that because I think you will find it very interesting. Moving right along, I will look a little bit at the flu season. Now, we all know we're in the midst of the flu season right now, but why is this the flu season here in the U.S. and much of the Northern Hemisphere? Well, it's colder right now. And I talked a little bit, I think, back in the fall about scientists were looking at some of the reasons why the flu virus seemed to be more robust in the wintertime. It seems kind of counterintuitive because everything else seems to slow down in the wintertime. And a lot of theories have been put out there, and most of them seem to make sense. But there's really been no hard evidence as to exactly what it is about the flu virus that makes it more robust in the wintertime. Some of the things discussed have been the fact that we're enclosed indoors in closed spaces, confined together without any fresh air movement, and that makes it easier to pass along the flu bug to each other. The other thing is that it's been found that the colder air seems to help carry the flu bug farther, that the moister air seems to inhibit somehow the flu virus. And this is what I wanted to get to because I found a study over at WebMD that is looking at exactly why it is that the humid air and the hotter air that is found in the summertime tends to inhibit the transmission of the flu virus, and the colder air seems to help. And they found that the flu virus gets cold and wears a coat in the winter time, just like we do. And it is that hardened coat of the flu virus that allows it to be carried easier throughout the air and to be passed on through transmission. And just like an M&M melts in your mouth and not in your hands, in fact, the flu virus, when it comes in contact with moist mucus surfaces in the body that are warm, that coat then melts away and the flu virus is then carried into the body much more easily. In fact, it has been found that in the summertime, this coat does not form, and therefore the flu virus's membrane is much more easily penetrated by environmental factors and in fact makes it more easy to kill. So that is why the flu virus is harder to transmit in the summer compared to the wintertime. But it also points out the thing that we've talked about time and again, the most preventable way to stop the transmission of the flu virus is to wash your hands regularly and often. Wash your hands for about 15 seconds using warm, soapy water, vigorously lathering up. A great way to do that is to hum Happy Birthday song to yourself, and during the course of that song, it's about 15 seconds, you can go ahead and rinse, use clean paper towels to dry off, and you will have dissolved the outer coating of the flu virus in the wintertime, destroying it more effectively and getting rid of it before you can pass it on to others or give it to yourself. So that's a quick look at why the flu virus is more easily transmitted in the wintertime. Finally, I will wrap up the news today with a story I found over at Medical News Today, looking at a study on clinical depression and its negative effects on heart attack patients. We see cardiac patients in the field all the time, and we need to be more aware of long-term outcomes for these patients, because patients who have had heart attacks and have cardiac conditions now, if they are not managed well, even by us in our relatively limited contact with them, can develop into cardiac arrests that none of us will really want to see in the field. We would like to save these patients well before they reach the point where we have to go ahead and try to defibrillate them or treat them with cardiac arrest protocols. One of the things this study looked at was the increased risk for these patients when they have a diagnosis of clinical depression, that there is a 2- to 4-fold increase in the person's risk of dying following a heart attack, even years later, years down the road. And previously, they thought the impact of depression was a short-term effect, maybe out to 6 months following their heart attack, but instead they have found that it lasts for at least 5 years, and maybe even farther along. So what does this mean for us in the EMS field? Well, during the course of our history taking with these patients, and you've heard me talk about it again, get in the habit of getting a good medical history from patients, because sometimes you'll hear something that they don't talk to with at the nurses at the ER or the physician at the ER. Sometimes you can hear something or see something in the field that can lead you to pass on that information and give the providers at the hospital who have not seen the living conditions, who have not seen the patient's interaction with their relatives at home, maybe give them an opportunity to better diagnose a treatment plan for this patient. And one of those things you can look for is signs of depression. Is this person taking good care of themselves? If they're living alone, are there signs that they haven't been eating well? You know, you can ask that question as part of your history taking. What do we ask about? Well, you know, our sample history, we get down there and see last oral intake. Well, not only that, but an elderly person, especially who lives alone, it is perfectly acceptable for you to ask the question, hey, have you been eating regular meals? Does somebody bring food in for you? Do you regularly go somewhere and get your food? Are you preparing meals yourself? You can even go as far as to take a quick moment and look inside the fridge. Okay? This is not prying. You are a medical provider, and you can if you get an opportunity to, if they're not able to answer for themselves, take a quick look around their kitchen. Look in their fridge. Is everything out of date? Is it mostly empty? Is there a whole host of unhealthy items in there that they're eating candy and drinking sodas rather than preparing good, healthful meals? All of these can be a sign of depression. And these patients can be at increased risk if they have a cardiac history. You can pass this along to the hospital. Say, look, I was at his house. I want to let you know he's living by himself. The house isn't being taken care of very well. And there doesn't seem like he's eating very well. And you pass this on to the nurse and say, you know, maybe they can be followed up on by the hospital social worker. Maybe this is something that you can track. This is something nurses pay very close attention to. They're going to discharge this patient either from the ER or they're going to pass that information along to the nurses on the med-surg floor, the cardiac floor, and those nurses are going to be discharging this patient. And they want to be aware of how to help this patient be the healthiest they can be following their hospitalization. One of those things is a good, strong look at the home environment and what they can do to make that better. And we are their frontline eyes and ears on that picture. This goes for cardiac patients. It goes for children in at-risk situations at home. It goes for battered spouses. It goes for anybody that's having problems in their living environment. We can be that bridge to other resources available in the community for these people. And offer them the best chance at good recovery. And guess what, folks? Offer them the best chance at not having to call us again. Again, this is one of the ways we can limit their call volume and limit the number of patients that are crowding the ERs so that we can save ourselves for true emergencies that come up that need our skills. And we can prevent having people go to the hospital so frequently by taking some steps and watching for things while we're in the home setting. That'll wrap up the news, and it's time now to move into this week's tip and trick of the week. I'm going to be looking at general patient assessment, just a quick overview and review for everybody out there on what we need to be looking for and watching for in patient assessment skills. And this goes back to that previous news story on some of the things we can be looking for that maybe we haven't thought about in the past. And one of the ways we can be more open to looking for those things is to make sure that we have a solid basis in our basic assessment skills so that we are comfortable stepping outside the box now and again when we need to conduct a less orthodox assessment of other things that might be going on in the environment around us. But that starts with having a firm basis in what we learned as EMTBs, if you're a paramedic, or you learned as an EMTB if you've been an EMT for a long time, or if you're in school right now. All of these things are just basic starter facts for how to handle a patient assessment. So let's go through the process of everything that goes into the patient assessment. First off, remember, we're going to think first of all about scene safety and our BSI skills, that body substance isolation, scene safety, and scene awareness. If you haven't heard the show recently, I did a show a month or so ago, or maybe 2 months ago, on scene safety specifically, and looked at some great resources on how to be prepared for scene safety. So you can check that out for more in-depth information there. But you want to review your dispatch information. You want to make sure that you're prepared for what you think you're going to see. And I say think you're going to see not because I think dispatchers give us bad information, but dispatchers only can give us the information they have. And that is based on a third person calling in most instances, and they may not have all of the information. So it is incumbent on us to be prepared for what we expect to see, but also to be prepared for the unexpected as well. We want to make sure we have our personal protective equipment. An extra pair of gloves in your pocket goes a long way in case you tear your gloves when you go to open the bag and you get caught on the zipper or something. You also want to make sure that you're evaluating the safety of the scene as you roll up to the scene and then ongoing. You want to not get that tunnel vision. You want to make sure you're aware of what's going on around you. You want to make sure you note how to get in and out of a situation and the exits from the house or the apartment in which you are located. You also want to make sure you know the number of patients you have, and you want to make sure you're aware of additional resources that may be needed when you arrive on scene. As you approach the patient or get closer to the scene, you want to start thinking about what it is that's causing the injury or the illness. The mechanism of injury, the nature of the illness are the next thing on your list of accessible items. You also want to make sure that you begin to implement triage procedures if you have a situation with multiple patients. It doesn't take 20 patients or 40 patients or 100 patients to create a mass casualty incident. It takes more patients than one provider can easily assess and deal with on their own. Two priority three relatively minor and stable patients may not require more than one EMT to do a quick assessment and prepare for transport. But you may find that a single priority three patient and a priority two or priority one patient is too much. So this is where you need to be prepared to do your triage and get started. So I say, you know, a mass casualty incident can be anything involving two or more patients that gives you a harder situation to handle than you can handle on your own. At that point, until more help arrives, it becomes an MCI, and triage procedures should take place. This means that the guy's holding his broken arm and screaming at you for pain meds and pain management and splinting doesn't get taken care of first because he's loudest if you have a patient who's experiencing respiratory distress and chest pain. You're going to deal with the chest pain and respiratory distress patient first because the loudest person is not necessarily the most injured person. Next up, you want to move into your ABCs. If you have a single patient, you want to go ahead and get started on that initial assessment of this patient. What are we looking at here? You're looking at your ABCDE, right? ABCs, airway. Is their airway open? If their airway is not open, you're going to open it. You're going to take any life-saving procedures and put them in place immediately upon encountering them during your initial assessment. B, are they breathing? Is there any signs of immediate bleeding? Now, I include this here because, yes, circulation implies that there's bleeding control involved too, but I don't see any reason why we can't use B for breathing and bleeding. If they're not breathing, you're going to start breathing for them. Then you're going to go ahead and check for and stop any major bleeding that might be occurring as well as you move into your C and circulation where you're checking to see if they have a pulse. Now, all of this is part of your CPR training, right? You're going to check for alertness. You're going to go ahead and go through. So next is D. D for disability. I use that as my cue to check and make sure that whether they're alert or not. Now this, how long have I taken in this going through ABCD? Probably 15, 20, 30 seconds tops. You're quickly assessing these patients. You're stopping where you need to stop to implement life-saving procedures, and then you're moving on. So you quickly assess, is the airway open? Hey, if they're talking to you, their airway's open. If they're talking to you, they're breathing. If they don't have pools of blood around them, they're not spurting blood, then they have good circulation. You can look at their color and assess their circulation. You can then assess their level of alertness and AVPU, alert to alert response? Are they alert to only verbal stimulus, painful stimulus, or completely unresponsive? You move on and check that next. Then E for expose. In an unresponsive patient, you want to expose them and try to assess for any injuries as appropriate based on the given situation. This is also where you're going to apply C-spine precautions if there's signs of loss of consciousness and there may have been a head or neck injury involved. Obviously, if you've already suspected a fall, you may have already implemented stabilization of the C-spine, but you may come upon a situation where you don't realize that there was a blow to the head until you get to this point and realize that they have altered mental status and you expose the patient and find out that they have an injury that may indicate that they have some cervical trauma. Next, you want to make sure you assign a priority to this patient. You want to decide, are they a stay and play or are they a load and go? Okay, are they a priority one two, three patient, and how fast and how quickly and which hospital you go to. That's as important as determining their priority, is taking them to the closest appropriate facility. If they're a stroke patient, they should go to your local stroke center if you have one. That may indicate, based on your protocols, that you bypass a closer facility that is 10 minutes closer, but the stroke center is just around the corner, maybe 5 or 10 minutes further down the road. That may be indicated in your protocols to go to that center instead. This includes trauma bypasses and other specialty bypass situations. Next, you move into your main assessment stage. You're now out of the initial assessment, and it's time to move into your main assessment. And this is going to differ depending on whether you have a trauma or a medical patient and whether that patient is alert and responsive or is not alert. And so this is going to vary somewhat, but this is the point where you're going to get your sample history. You're going to want to find out your signs and symptoms of what's going on, allergies, medications, pertinent recent history, last oral intake, and events that led up to the incident and the reason you're there. You also want to look at your OPQRST. This is your onset, provokes, quality, radiation, severity, and time, and usually related to pain, but can also be applied to other types of signs and symptoms, such as respiratory distress. There may be things that you can use this particular device to apply to people that are having respiratory problems or other discomfort that isn't directly related to pain. You're going to want to perform a focused physical assessment on patients that have focused problems. Of course, in unresponsive patients or patients with unknown issues, you're going to want to do your full head-to-toe examination. That includes your DCAP BTLS assessment of every single patient. Deformity, contusion, abrasion, punctures, burns, tenderness, lacerations, and swelling. All are things you're going to look through for on every single part of the body. You want to make sure that you're assessing these patients completely. Check for pupillary response. Go ahead and move all the way down to the body and remember to check for distal pulses. You're going to get a set of vital signs and you're going to go ahead and get this patient moving down the road if you already haven't done so, unless you have an immediate treatment that you want to perform, a medication or something that you need to give. Also, remember that multiple parts of this assessment process can be done at the same time if you have more than one person or provider on the scene. Certainly, if you are both EMTs or a combination of EMTs, paramedics, or whatever, you can split up those duties. Somebody can be doing your vital signs while someone else is getting your assessment finished. These are all things that can be done at the same time and get finished. Then remember that you're going to, once en route to the hospital, you're going to want to reassess these patients following the same steps. You're going to do that quick initial assessment real quick. You're going to go ahead and do a focused assessment. You want to reassess pain levels. You want to reassess the entire history process, really. I always verify a lot of the parts of my sample history. I always say, now, you said you were allergic to penicillin. Are you allergic to anything else? Because I'll tell you, I've been burned more than once by somebody who said, oh, yeah, I am allergic to peanuts. And I, you know, had something to eat that had peanuts in it yesterday. And I've been feeling bad and having some problems breathing ever since. You need to know this information, and it doesn't hurt to revisit some of these questions. Also, it's a great way to reassess mental status. If they are unable to answer questions they easily answered a few minutes ago, this may be a sign of some deteriorating problem caused by the ongoing problem for which you were called. Remember to follow up as part of your ongoing assessment on every single intervention you've performed. If you gave a med, you want to see if it worked. That means assessing vital signs sometimes. Sometimes it means assessing pain levels again. Sometimes it means checking to make sure that swelling hasn't occurred that's caused your splint to become too tight and you need to retie or re-strap your splints. All of this needs to be done frequently and reassess distal pulses. So every intervention that you've performed to date needs to be followed up on. And this is the same for every single patient and every situation, no matter how small the intervention was to begin with. So that's a quick overview of patient assessment. And I hope that you got a sense of review from that. And of course, there's a lot more that could be done to follow up on this, but maybe we'll have to look at that in future episodes. I'll move now into the med of the week. And this week, I'm going to do a brief overview of club drugs. There's just a lot of information that can be talked about in this particular topic area. And I will urge you to head over and check out the links in the show notes that will take you over to the National Institute for Drug Abuse and the site they have on club drugs to get a whole lot more information. There's a great resource there for you that has information for parents, for students, for healthcare and medical professionals, all over at the NIDA site. And that can be found at nida.nih.gov. Briefly, club drugs are those medications that are frequently used by teenagers and young adults at bars, clubs, concerts, and parties. And as we head into the spring prom season here in the United States, it is more likely that you're going to run into these medications in your particular area and are definitely something that you need to keep your eyes open for. Some of the street names and common medications that we are seeing on the street include ecstasy, Special K, vitamin K, known as ketamine. Ecstasy is MDMA, is the drug, but can be known as ecstasy or X. Liquid ecstasy and soap, also known as GHB, roofies or Rohypnol. And there's also been some evidence that Rohypnol is being replaced by other benzodiazepine medications. And so you need to be watching for some of those drugs out there as well. Specifically, two drugs that are being seen recently to replace Rohypnol include clonazepam or Clonopin and Alprazolam or Xanax. Both of these seem to be appearing more frequently as a benzodiazepine medication appearing in the club drug scene. So what are some of the things that we need to be aware of? Well, first of all, remember ecstasy is frequently seen as a harmless drug. However, it has significant psychoactive effects. It's similar in composition to methamphetamines, as well as having a component that is very similar to the hallucinogen mescaline. So this provides a general increase in body metabolism coupled with some hallucinogenic effects and is one of the reasons it's seen as a feel-good kind of drug. However, it can cause fatal episodes of extreme hyperthermia because of the increased metabolic effects. And so these patients can become quickly dehydrated and because of their dehydration have additional long-term effects based on their mental status. Also, GHB is also a drug that is seen frequently for its euphoric and sedative and anabolic bodybuilding effects. However, it's been banned for sale in the United States, known as liquid ecstasy, soap, Easy Lay, Vita G, Georgia Homeboy, can be seen to induce coma and seizures in patients, and breathing difficulties is also used as a date rape drug. And can have significant withdrawal effects, including insomnia, anxiety, tremors, and sweating. So patients that may have been in a club taking this drug recently may the next day present with some of these withdrawal effects. Ketamine is a significant synthetic medication used for sedative effects. It is used a lot in the veterinary environment and can be injected or snorted, known as Special K or Vitamin K, produces a dreamlike euphoric state, can induce hallucinations, but it can cause delirium, amnesia, as well as significant depression and fatal respiratory issues. And finally, Rohypnol, as I said, is known as roofies, is considered a date rape drug and can produce anterograde amnesia where the patient doesn't remember what happened while they were under the effects of the drug. And this drug is also banned in the United States, but can be bought and brought in from other countries. So somebody who's traveled in or been in contact with people who've traveled in from other areas may be under the effects of this particular medication. So that's a really quick overview of some of the most significant club drugs available out there. You can check out the website for more information. I'd also talk to your local poison control center and hospital environment and find out if they've seen anything coming into the emergency rooms that may indicate there are other drugs being used in your region. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show. Remember, there are links to everything I talked about in the show notes from this episode, so you can go ahead and check those links out for yourself. It is incumbent on you to make sure you refer back to your own protocols and your own training when trying to apply any of the information. I present this stuff here for review and informational purposes, but really, it is up to you to be a critical thinking EMS provider in the field and check with your local training officer, your medical director, or your own set of protocols to before you implement anything that I've discussed here specifically on the show or on the website. And you can find out more about the terms of use over at medicast.com in the About page. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me here by sending me email at podmedic@mac.com. You can reach me via the Skype voiceover internet service and leave a message on the voicemail by calling me at my Skype ID, podmedic. And you can also reach me by voicemail using the phone at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I'll close out, as I always do, with a great piece of PodSafe music. This week, another song from the artist Ingrid Michaelson. I played one of her tunes last week. This is another one of her songs that caught my ear, so to speak, and I thought I would share it all with you. This song's coming off the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com, and there's also a link in the show notes that'll take you directly to Ingrid's site. I urge you to check out her music, and if you like what you hear, let her know you heard it here on the MedicCast. You can also buy her songs directly. I've got a link over to the iTunes store if you'd like to pick up her songs. You can click that link and get her music there as well. So without further ado, I'll move on into Ingrid's song, Die Alone, and I'll leave you with that and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, remember, scene safety, BSI.
Up this morning, a funny taste in my head, spackled some butter over my whole grain bread. Something tastes different, maybe it's my tongue. Something tastes different, suddenly I'm not so young. To leave me sore, maybe.
Never thought I could love anyone.